Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. And I am particularly pleased to have one of the more insightful observers and reporters on the subject, a crack investigative reporter, now with Breitbart.com, previously with The Daily Caller. He's Matt Boyle. Matt, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Great to be here, Frank.
You have been doing some very important reporting on the evident determination of the Obama administration to accommodate, some might say appease, Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president that they helped come to power in Egypt, in his demand that we release a fellow by the name or the nom de guerre, shall we say, of the Blind Sheikh. Tell us about the Blind Sheikh and tell us what on earth is going on here.
All right, so the Blind Sheikh is one of these, convicted terrorists. He's currently serving a life imprisonment in a North Carolina federal penitentiary. He was convicted in the mid-90s by then Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrew McCarthy for his involvement in helping to plot the 1993 attacks on the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center in New York City. Of course, that was the predecessor to 9/11, Al-Qaeda's first attempt at, and it was a successful attempt. Many people were injured. Bombs were set off.
Six of them killed, as I recall.
Right, and some were killed as well. The first attempt at the World Trade Center, and then, of course, they came back in 2001. This man was convicted in 1995. So in recent months, what we've seen is that the Islamist community has been, you know, very heavily advocating that this man be either released from prison or granted familial visitation rights that he doesn't have, or be transferred to custody in Egypt. The argument that these people are making is that, oh, well, he learned his lesson, and, you know, he's not going to do this again, you know,
yeah,
he's
trust
old.
Me.
Right. And, well, I mean, the thing is, the guy was, intimately involved with and was one of the senior members of the plot of a terrorist plot to attack the United States World Trade Center in New York City.
Right. And Matt Boyle, what's more important in a way is that Osama bin Laden, the perpetrator, of course, of the second attack on the World Trade Center, cited the Blind Sheikh, Omar Abdulrahman, as the religious legitimator of his attack. So this is prime examples of how this guy works. And this has prompted Michael McCaul, the new chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, to issue a very powerful statement warning against releasing this guy. Tell us what Michael McCaul's concerns are, and do you think this is likely to stave off the apparent determination of the Obama administration to go down this road?
Well, at this time, I think it's worth saying that the administration is, at least publicly, from all their different facets of the administration, are saying that they have no plans to release the Blind Sheikh. But shortly after President Obama's reelection a few weeks ago now, President Mohamed Morsi, the Egyptian president, did an interview with CNN in which he says that he's going to heavily lobby President Obama to do this. Now, like I said, the administration at this point in time is publicly saying that they're not going to do this. That said, it's pretty clear that the leader, the public face of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi, plans to. He did so in an interview on CNN. The details of the meeting haven't been set yet, but in March he's scheduled to come to the United States and meet directly with President Obama. And he says that he plans to use that meeting to, among other things, push for the release of this man from U.S. prison. With all of this is that Even though the administration is currently saying they're not going to do this, they do have a history of buckling to the demands of these kinds of people. So they may do so as part of a grander bargain or some other kind of dealings with Egypt. Depends on how hard Morsi puts his foot down on this. But it definitely appears as though he's going to push very hard for
Matt Boyle, you mentioned our friend Andy McCarthy, who appears on our program each week, and he has said on our air and elsewhere, as has, by the way, the judge who convicted the blind sheikh and his co-conspirators back in 1995, Judge Michael Mukasey, former Attorney General of the United States, that they fully expect the president to buckle, as you say, and we're very, very anxious about it. We have especially, I think, reason to be concerned about this to the extent that the president seems intent on bringing to positions of high office people who, if anything, would seem to be even more sympathetic than he to this idea. John Kerry for the State Department, Chuck Hagel for the Defense Department. John Brennan, of course, would simply be moving from one advisory position to another out at the CIA. But the cumulative effect of this almost certainly is to be populating the senior ranks of this administration with people who are, if anything, as I say, even more anxious to appease and accommodate the Islamists.
No, absolutely. And with Kerry, there's a little bit more of a background there in that Kerry was kind of a victory for Republicans in that, Susan Rice was originally going to have that slot. And the president really wanted her, but ended up settling for Kerry after Republicans really fought to shoot that down. So, I mean, with that, and Susan Rice would have been much worse than Kerry, I think, on a lot of this. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. But when you look at Hagel, I think, is the perfect example of President Obama basically siding with that worldview publicly by the person he picks to be in that spot. Yeah, he's given it a little bit of political cover, or he's at least tried to, with the fact that Hagel is a former Republican senator. But, I mean, you know, for Senator Hagel is pretty, very, very public in his anti-Israel statements. As well as other controversial views that he has, and it's pretty clear that the president wants people with that worldview running the departments in his second term.
Among the controversial views, which we'll be discussing in the course of the program, are not just the antipathy towards Israel, which is pretty evident, but also the willingness to, as I say, engage and embrace the Iranians, Hamas, Hezbollah, and obviously the Muslim Brotherhood as well. Matt, what we're seeing is, of course, a rallying around Chuck Hagel at the moment by a number of eminences, establishment types, realists, they call themselves. I think that's totally inappropriate. But what does it say about the establishment that we're seeing it seemingly validating, endorsing, and associating itself with a guy with Chuck Hagel's extreme views?
Well, what you see, and you see this with a lot of fights for the so-called establishment on the right, as well as, and this goes for both sides, but, especially on the right here. What you have to have here is that you have to have a fully informed Senate. I mean, I think ultimately, though, with Hagel, it's going to come down to Chuck Schumer. And just so everybody knows, I mean, that really says something about this, that Chuck Schumer, one of the most extreme liberal Democrats, is not on board with the president's decision here, fully, at least not yet. And we'll see where he goes, but because of his views on Israel. But what you have is you have an establishment that's in Washington that's more interested in going along to get along, cut another deal, move on to the next day, instead of stepping up to address the problems at hand. And we see this across all facets of political life, not just the Muslim Brotherhood issues, but we also see it in the death fights. We see it in you name the fight, we see this happening. Like, that's the thing, is that they're more interested in not picking a fight and moving on to the next day and just go along to get along type of thing.
Let's make a deal.
Standing up for the right thing. Yeah, let's make a deal. And that's the thing is that I think you really start to see the character of some of these establishment types. So we'll see what happens with the Hagel nomination. I think there's going to be a fight there, absolutely. And
there really has to be. That's the key thing. And Matt Boyle at Breitbart.com, we appreciate so much your efforts to help illuminate that fight and what's at stake. And we look forward to visiting with you, I hope early and often, in the course of its progress through the Senate and hopefully the defeat of Chuck Hagel. We'll be talking next with Claire Lopez about another reason why that should be the order of the day, namely the prospect of the post-Americans, including Chuck Hagel, enabling a growing threat from Iran. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. One of my favorite guests and friends and colleagues, for that matter, is Claire Lopez. She is a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy. She is also a duty expert with RadicalIslam.org. A woman who has served her country with distinction for many years as a career operations officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, for about 20 years, as a matter of fact. She has gone on to serve in other capacities, notably trying to educate those who are currently in or getting into the business of protecting our country, our intelligence services. Claire Lopez, welcome back. I think this is our first conversation on the air in 2013, so Happy New Year to you.
Well, thank you, Frank, and a Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you. A lot of reason to believe it may not be all that happy, and that's one of the things that, of course, we wanted most urgently to visit with you about, specifically the Islamic Republic of Iran. Claire, you have really developed tremendous expertise on what these characters are up to in Tehran. And I wanted to visit with you about this, not least because, as we were talking about with Matt Boyle in the previous segment, we have not only a president and several nominees to senior positions in the U.S. government, but it seems a kind of establishment elite all of whom seem to think that there's really no problem with Iran getting the bomb, or if it is a problem, it's certainly one we can contend with. And I just wanted to sort of get an update from you, Claire, as to what the latest assessment is of the proximity of the Iranian regime to having and perhaps being able to wield nuclear weapons.
Right. Well, I think one of the most disturbing trends, Frank, that we saw over the past year, 2012, was made evident in the quarterly reports from the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency,
right,
which documented with a great deal of specificity the continuing steps that Iran is taking on the road to a deliverable nuclear weapon. And those include things like additional enrichment activities, which they refuse to halt despite a number of resolutions from the United Nations and Security Council demanding that they do so. Enriching to a higher level of purity, which gets them closer to the ability to have weapons-grade uranium for a bomb. And then the new revelations that recently have become public through Reza Khalili, a former member, actually, of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC in Iran, who reported to the CIA as a reporting agent for a number of years. He's now a citizen with his family, lives in the United States, but retains contacts over there with the IRGC. And his latest reporting, very disturbing, I think, talks about a new secret facility called Khondab, and it's near the city of Arak, in the central part of Iran. There are satellite photographs to be seen at WND, the World Net Daily, which published this story. The overhead satellite images show a facility apparently underground, underneath a mountain at that site in Khondab. The report says that there are as many as 2,000 centrifuges spinning away down there, enriching uranium, and of course unknown, or as best we know, unknown to the IAEA. So the continuing activity that is clandestine and geared towards achievement in secret of a nuclear weapons capability, I think, is the most disturbing part of this.
And Claire Lopez, does the fact that it would appear there is at least one facility like this that we didn't know about suggest that maybe estimates that the IAEA, I believe, has produced recently to the effect that Iran is a year or so away still from having a nuclear weapon, almost certainly now off by some factor, if not completely irrelevant, certainly, wildly optimistic?
For sure. This new revelation about this new site, Khondab, is but the latest in a sequence of revelations about nuclear weapons development sites that Iran has kept secret from the IAEA and the world. We'll recall that the world and the IAEA did not know publicly that Iran even had an active nuclear weapons development program until 2002, when an opposition group made the first revelations about Natanz, the enrichment facility, and eventually others like Isfahan, the conversion facility. And through the years, more and more secret facilities like these have come to light. Just before this one, the most recent, was another enrichment site called Fordow near the Iranian seminary city, I guess you would say, of Qom. And again, under a mountain built to withstand possibly attacks as well as scrutiny from the air, from satellites. And so this is a pattern. And where these keep coming to light, of course there must be others. And as well, the source that Reza Khalili is talking to talks about additional sites, as many as 7 more besides Khondab.
This is obviously a piece of the puzzle, a tip of the iceberg, whatever metaphor you wish to use, Claire Lopez, with the Center for Security Policy and also radicalislam.org. Claire, we don't have time to get into it, but just to touch on several other facets that are very worrying are the developments, as you know, of what appears to be the makings of an electromagnetic pulse attack capability when these nuclear weapons become available to the Iranian regime. Biological weapons that have apparently and reportedly now been uploaded in ballistic missiles ready to go against Israel. A huge buildup in the identified terror networks associated with Iran, not only through Hezbollah, but its very own. And I guess what this all demands an answer to, Claire, not so much from you, but from people like Chuck Hagel, the candidate to become the Secretary of Defense, and John Brennan, the candidate to become the next Director of Central Intelligence, and John Kerry, the candidate to become the next Secretary of State, is why do these folks think that we can safely engage further with the Iranian regime, buying them more time and allowing them perhaps to get to the point where they actually could use these sorts of horrific weapons against our allies and perhaps us?
Yeah, that's totally perplexing to me, Frank. We hear in comments over the years from these candidates to be Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and CIA Director John Brennan that they, at the very minimum, downgrade, if not dismiss, these very real threats that you're talking about, the biological weapons capability, the EMP capability that Iran has, that North Korea has. Its satellite launch of last month, December 2012, demonstrated a three-stage ICBM capability that can reach continental United States on the West Coast.
Right.
These are very serious threats from Iran and from North Korea and others. You talk about the terrorist network as well. And yet these candidates, Kerry, Hagel, and Brennan, either downplay them to what I would consider to be an irresponsible level.
Claire, let me ask you this, if I can, mm-hmm. because we're almost out of time. To what extent do you attribute, in the case particularly of Chuck Hagel, this downplaying to what appeared to be rather striking ties to the Iran lobby in the United States?
Well, that's an interesting point, Frank, because we saw that one of his defenders who sprang into an op-ed piece defending his candidacy for Secretary of Defense was none other than Trita Parsi, the founder president of NIAC, National Iranian American Council, which recently lost a very important lawsuit, a legal case that it itself had brought, and for the reason that the judge decided that it, in fact, was, as the defendant, Hassan Dayol Eslam, stated, NIAC was acting as an agent of influence for the regime in Tehran. And to have that kind of endorsement for Chuck Hagel, I think needs a second look.
Yeah, born of evidently long associations with NIAC and other instruments of the Iranian influence operation in the United States. I hope it does indeed get a second look. Indeed, very much I hope it'll get a first look, really, in the course of these hearings. And Claire Lopez, your work at the Center for Security Policy and elsewhere, as well as, of course, your service in the Central Intelligence Agency, are deeply appreciated and I hope will be drawn upon for the purpose of exploring and hopefully preventing the placement in the senior-most Defense Department position of somebody closely tied to the Iranian regime. Claire, thank you so much for joining us. As always, it's great to talk with you. Next up, we have Peter Husey. We'll get from the Iranian nuclear program to ours and what's left of it. Straight ahead.
The Special Forces in the War of Ideas, Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feed the pig!
AIAVA.org. This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The war between jihadists and the West has a new front, the West African nation of Mali, where Islamists now control an area roughly the size of France, which formerly colonized the place. Declaring that Al-Qaeda-associated elements must not be allowed to establish and operate from new safe havens, the French have recently started bombing them in northern Mali. Reportedly, they are being helped by the United States and the UK. Ironically, the effort to roll back the territorial gains of Sharia-adherent jihadis comes at the same time the French, British, and Americans are helping other Islamists to take over Syria. There are even 750 places in France itself that are no-go zones for non-Muslims. The West must defeat efforts to impose Sharia worldwide. To do so, however, will require clarity, competence, and consistency. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
I'm a champion, realize checks mechanism.
Hi, Shaquille O'Neal for Rad. This is not your normal PSA. Don't be stupid. Don't drink and drive. If you're going to go out and have a good time, it's fine. But designate a driver to drive home. Let's stop the madness. Don't drink and drive.
Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Peter Husey. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis, a national security fellow of the American Foreign Policy Council and a senior defense consultant at the Air Force Association. He's also one of the guys in Washington, D.C., who thinks seriously about and tries to educate the rest of us, most especially people on Capitol Hill, but the rest of us as well, about some of the most important issues of our national security, many of which are really getting very little attention elsewhere, notably the importance of nuclear deterrence. And Peter has just written a very important essay for the marvelous Gatestone Institute talking about this whole notion of global zero. And Peter, before we get into the central message of your piece about one of the more troubling adherents to this idea of ridding the world of all nuclear weapons, tell us a little bit about Global Zero, the campaign, where it stands, and what it's trying actually to accomplish.
Well, thank you, Frank. The Global Zero campaign is trying to do a whole series of things, but primarily it is trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal, reduce their role in deterrence of any kind, take away the money that goes into maintaining and sustaining even the current level and lower levels of nuclear weapons, but also dismantling all the deterrent requirements which we have had both during the Cold War and after the Cold War.
Now, does this sound as unilateral as what you just described? Is it not wrapped up, at least rhetorically, in the notion that the whole world will follow suit here? But is it, in fact, really, basically, let's rid the world of nuclear weapons starting with ours?
Well, Frank, this is where they're clever. They will say the United States has to lead by example, but they never say when that example stops moving, okay? How far down from the current 1,550 deployed warheads do we go before we figure out the other guys aren't following suit? Interestingly, Kim Jong-il, the former dictator of North Korea, was asked whether he would follow us in going down to zero nuclear weapons, and he said, well, you first. We never know at what point does the U.S. restraint, if it doesn't engender restraint on the other side, at what point do we stop?
Right.
The nuclear zero people never say when. They just say, well, we need to do more.
You know, this reminds me, Peter, you're one of the people in Washington who actually has the corporate memory to recall this as well, but it reminds me of former Secretary of Defense Harold Brown famously declaring with some frustration, I think back when he was in office in the Carter administration, that when we build our nuclear forces, the then Soviet Union builds its nuclear forces. When we stop building our nuclear forces, the Soviet Union continues to build its. Is a similar yeah. kind of dynamic at work at the moment. Because clarify this for us, if you would, Peter Husey, the extent to which we are indeed denuclearizing the United States. How is this global zero concept actually being translated into policy by the Obama administration?
Well, we had a commitment under the New START Treaty to spend roughly $20 to $22 billion a year on the entire nuclear enterprise. And the money that was put in the bill, primarily because of the insistence of former Senator Kyle, was about, I would say, $10 billion over a five-year plan. All that money has now been taken out in the budget submission by the administration. However, this Congress just required that the new bomber being built by the Air Force, or in the process of being built, we're not yet in production, has to be nuclear armed when it comes out. But we've delayed our submarine force construction and replacement, and we have not yet figured out what to do with our land-based missiles. And our labs are in disarray, and the National Nuclear Security Administration that runs all the warhead programs, they're not going in the right direction. They have a lot of unsolved problems. So if you were a zero doing nothing and 100 doing what you should do, I think we're somewhere around 40, Frank. And yet Russia and China, Pakistan, and others are moving very rapidly in the direction of modernizing their nuclear forces, producing more cruise missiles, bombers, submarines, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, mobile land-based missiles across the board. So we're in a very, very much of a catch-up mode in terms of modernization and sustainment.
Except we are not even trying to catch up, as I understand it, Peter Husey. And again, Peter is the president of Geostrategic Analysis and a National Security Fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. You can find his most recent writing on this subject at Gatestone Institute. And Peter, part of what makes this so ominous is we have a president who has made it national policy to rid the world of nuclear weapons. We have a budget situation teeing up with this sequestration that almost certainly is going to provide budgetary vehicles for further eviscerating our nuclear deterrent. And now the President of the United States has designated as the next Secretary of Defense, the Senate willing, a man who actually has very publicly embraced this global zero program, and specifically some aspects of it that are especially alarming. Tell us about those and Chuck Hagel's views.
Yeah, I think, Frank, everybody can say, going back to every president since the nuclear age, has said, ultimately, we would like to get rid of these things. And certainly President Reagan said that, but said, in the meantime, keep your powder dry. Mr. Hagel has proposed, along with General Cartwright and others, three things nuclear deterrent policy that I find alarming. One is to de-alert our missiles, meaning take the warheads off, store them somewhere where you can't use them in a crisis. It's not verifiable, and as Larry Welch, the former chief of staff of the Air Force, has pointed out, in a crisis there would be a real incentive to re-alert and certainly do it surreptitiously. The second thing Hagel said in this Global Zero report is a very strange notion that nuclear weapons should no longer play a deterrent role. And he said this in an interview with Al Jazeera in 2009, but he didn't say what would replace it. And to me, that's really very troubling. And the third thing is he proposed to get rid of our ICBM leg of the triad, all our Minuteman missiles and our bombers. And again, as Larry Welch has pointed out, and Frank Miller and a whole host of other very knowledgeable people, we currently have about 500 targets that the other bad guys would have to take out to get rid of all our nuclear weapons. And they're not going to do that. That's impossible. But Mr. Hagel's proposal would go down to 10 or less. Each of these targets, submarines at sea or submarines in port, could be taken out with non-nuclear weapons, which means, and surreptitiously, we would know underwater who had taken out our submarines. That gives an incentive to the other guy, as General Scowcroft wrote years ago in a Washington Post editorial, come get me. And that, to me, Frank, is highly destabilizing. And notice each of these things, de-alerting, getting rid of the land-based and bomber-based leg of the triad, and diminishing and eliminating the deterrent role for nuclear weapons, I think gives you a highly unstable crisis environment where the incentive for the other guy to keep and use nuclear weapons is heightened, as opposed to what I think you and I would agree and everybody agreed to, the whole point of arms control and deterrent policy is to dramatically reduce the incentives to use nuclear weapons in any crisis.
Yeah, that should certainly be the purpose. It's not likely in most cases that that will be the effect. And Peter Husey, that's what's so really deeply troubling about this, is we've seen a sort of policy construct that used to be, I think quite properly, regarded as lunatic fringe, now being formalized as American policy. And just in closing, Peter, we've only got a minute. You mentioned China as and one country in particular. I'm going to be talking more about this momentarily with Gordon Chang. But is there any evidence that the communist Chinese are interested in pursuing Global Zero with us?
Well, no. I think Senator Conrad, retired from North Dakota, has said it very well in September. He said, given the uncertainties in Russia, uncertainties particularly in China, he said we should have a strategic pause, no further reductions in nuclear weapons, maintain what we have, sustain and modernize that force, and take a look at the world in 2018, 2017, when the New START treaty technically expires. We could extend it, he said. I think the Chinese have said, first of all, they don't like multilateral deals. And they would have to come into any deal when we start going down below where we are today.
Unless we simply decide to go down without them, which seems to be the administration's plan. Peter, I've got to let you go. We're out of time.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. Peter Husey, one of the real national security-minded experts on these national and nuclear-related issues of great importance to us all.
Peter Husey, thank you very much for your insights. Keep up the good work. We'll look forward to talking with you about these nuclear security issues as the Hagel nomination progresses. Next up, Gordon Chang joins us to talk more about this Chinese threat. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Up in the morning and out to school. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there.
So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff.
Like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, who I'm happy to say has returned safely stateside after an extended tour of Asia, from which he reported to us, twice in the course of his travels. Gordon Chang, welcome back. It's good to have you home.
Thank you very much, Frank. And it's great to be back on U.S. soil.
I'm glad you feel that way. Listen, Gordon, we were speaking in the segment previous to this one with our friend Peter Husey about the Obama administration's nominees for various senior national security posts and their embrace to varying degrees, in the case of Chuck Hagel most explicitly, of this idea that we can rid the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours. And I want to just spend some time with you today visiting about how China is actually looking at nuclear weapons and whether it has any indication, we have any indication that China is actually interested in eliminating its deterrent, or are they doing something rather different? And if you can shed some light on the ways in which they're doing something different, that would be tremendously helpful.
Yeah, Frank, China has no intention of reducing its nuclear weapons capability. You know, we go back to that book, Unrestricted Warfare, by two colonels in the People's Liberation Army, who talk about using nuclear weapons in combination with other types of warfare that we would think just grossly inappropriate. But I also go back to the comments of a retired Chinese general, Xu Guangyu, in Hong Kong's South China Morning Post from August 2011, because General Xu talked about
a surprise missile attack on the United States. And he actually blurted out a comment that indicates that the Chinese generals are actually contemplating this. What happened is there was this WikiLeaks revelation that in 2010, Secretary of State Clinton sent a cable to four American embassies asking officials in those embassies to alert our allies of an upcoming Chinese ballistic missile interceptor test. And in the cable, she had some pretty sensitive information. She had the launch sites for the interceptor and the target, the models of the missiles, the purpose of the test, and the test date. Now, General Hsu, commenting in the South China Morning Post, said a lot of this information could, of course, been gathered by American satellites. But he said that two parts of this information, the purpose of the test and the test date, could only have been learned from sources on the ground. In other words, WikiLeaks revealed that the United States had spies in China's Strategic Missile Corps. And this is probably the most serious revelation in WikiLeaks. But nonetheless, General Hsu then went on to say this. He said, quote, "If China could no longer keep secret its missile launches, it would not be able to launch a surprise attack on the U.S. Now, this is a blurted out comment, and I think that it indicates that the Chinese, as part of their nuclear weapons doctrine, are thinking about the first use of nuclear weapons against the United States, something that we think to be totally impossible. Now, I actually don't think the Chinese want to do this, but nonetheless, we have to understand Chinese thinking, which is very different than our nuclear doctrines.
We do, and more to the point, Gordon Chang, as this sort of insight into Chinese doctrine suggests, we also have some insights from what they're doing with respect to their nuclear forces. And I want to just quickly remind our listeners of something you and I have talked about a lot, namely the so-called underground Great Wall of China. Talk to us about what that immense undertaking suggests about the level of commitment to the Chinese nuclear strike capability and what it might mean in terms of its size.
Going back to the Maoist years and continuing to today, China is building tunnels throughout the country, which are thought to house mobile missile launchers. Now, this network is, there is disagreement about the size of this network, but nonetheless, it is enormous. And it indicates that China's nuclear arsenal might indeed be much larger than current estimates indicate. This means that you cannot have any sort of discussion with the Russians about reduction in nuclear arsenals unless the Chinese are also in the room, because the Chinese have an arsenal and we don't know the size of it. And how can you negotiate with the Russians when we don't know how big the Chinese arsenal is? Now, this is in combination with reports in the Washington Free Beacon of a day or so ago that Beijing has been fortifying its subway system to withstand nuclear attacks. You don't do that unless you're thinking that a nuclear attack might be probable, because it's an enormous waste of resources if there is peace. But if there isn't peace, then this is obviously very, very important thing to have. So, again, this highlights the thinking of the Chinese, which is obviously they have a very different nuclear doctrine than we do. And so we got to take that into account whenever we think about the size of our arsenal.
We do indeed. And in addition to this piece by Bill Gertz at the Washington Free Beacon that you've referred to, which is stunning, in addition to protecting their people against nuclear attack, apparently they're also hardening the subways against gas, which is a whole nother kettle of fish. But Gordon Chang, one other thing that Bill and I talked about last week and that I know you're tracking is China's apparent aggressive pursuit of the capability to attack American satellites in space, perhaps commercial as well as military assets, even at what's called geosynchronous orbit, very, very high altitudes. How does that fit into this doctrine as you see it, as one of the country's leading experts on Asia and, of course, a columnist at Forbes.com and World Affairs Journal? Does this strike you as further evidence not only of the determination of the Chinese to have first order superpower capabilities, but perhaps to use them as well?
Obviously, if China can blind the American satellites, then it could launch a first attack. It could do all sorts of things to cripple the American military and also to destroy the American homeland. This comes in combination with a number of things. You know, they have been very persistent in their anti-satellite tests. We expect another one in the pretty near future. And this indicates that real preparations for war planning. You got to remember that Chinese generals every 5 years or so threaten to eradicate Los Angeles. And this is, I think, again, more evidence of their thinking that nuclear weapons could actually be used. And finally, we have to remember that China is the only nation in history that has threatened to use nuclear weapons against territory it considers its own, specifically in this case, Taiwan. This is just unprecedented. You know, it's one thing to attack a potential adversary. It's another thing to use nuclear weapons on your own people. This shows a disregard of human life that is just unknown in the West.
And Gordon Chang, in the same regard, the threat that this represents to the people of the region, as you say, people who consider themselves Chinese as well as people who are not, is obviously prompting a greater and greater degree of concern in other quarters. You've written about Japan's values diplomacy and its decision under the new Abe government to build up its military after some years of decline. Do you think, Gordon Chang, that the aggressiveness on the part of the Chinese that is precipitating these concerns in South Korea, in Japan, in Taiwan, and elsewhere, is happening in part because the Chinese are emboldened by what they perceive now as a perhaps dominant, certainly more than adequate, nuclear strike capability?
Well, the Chinese right now are indeed suffering from a very bad case of overconfidence. It started really with the Obama administration, which came into office with this unusually conciliatory view of China. And remember, we go back to February 2009 when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the United States would downgrade human rights in our discussions with China. And she meant that as to be a signal of cooperation. But the Chinese took that to be a sign of weakness, and they went on a foreign policy bender, actually attacking an unarmed U.S. Navy reconnaissance vessel in the following month. And then things went downhill from there. And clearly what has happened in the region is countries have reacted to Chinese aggressiveness over the last 2 years. And so we hear people like Prime Minister Shinzo Abe talk about fundamental human rights and democracy as being the basis of Japanese foreign policy. We should take that as the basis of ours as well, because the Chinese clearly, it's the problem of their government and the nature of their system that is creating these problems in and around their periphery.
Indeed. And those problems almost certainly will grow worse as this capability expands further in space and in terms of nuclear capabilities. I appreciate, Gordon Chang, your insight so much as always. It's great to have you home. We've run out of time to talk about the Google Bill Richardson boondoggle to North Korea, but we'll do that with you next week. In the meantime, thank you so much for your superb insights into these matters and your sharing them with us each week. We'll look forward to talking with you next week and to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.